Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. We're also pleased to have back on the program this morning Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice in our area. She also teaches at the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month, on a Monday, she is here and we talk about women's health. She comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new, or perhaps there are things that she would just like you to know about, and we can do that. However, also, we're here to take your questions, and I know that she would be happy to respond to whatever might be on your mind, certainly as long as it falls within her area of practice, and that covers a lot of territory. We've talked about a lot of different things with her over the years. I know that she will do her best to help. Whenever we have physicians here on the program, one of the things I like to try to remind people is that we cannot do diagnosis over the phone. So keep that in mind. There are some limits to what we can do because the doctor can't see you, and obviously she doesn't know your whole medical history. But having said that, I know that she will do her best, and we also do these programs to add to your store of health knowledge. So after all that, I'll give you the telephone numbers if you want to give us a call. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. And we do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you can call. Well, welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Glad to have you here. I know that you have some things that you would be interested in talking about. What would you like to tell people about here to start out?
Well, there was an interesting study about passive smoking, and I think that we have talked a little bit about passive smoking. I think it's probably a subject that you deal with in some of the general health segments on your show. And we in gynecology link smoking to a lot of issues in health. We know, for instance, that pregnant women who smoke actually have smaller babies. We know that women who smoke have had a higher rate of cervical cancer. Women who smoke have had a higher rate of being diagnosed with tubal pregnancies. Of course, then there are the lung and lung cancer issues. And there has been some news regarding cancer statistics in the United States as well that I could talk about later. And there's always been a lot of discussion about passive smoke exposure and whether how serious or not serious this is. And I know that it's been in the public attention a lot because individual places of business have taken the steps of banning smoking in their establishments over the past 5 years. We've seen a big growth in that. And there was a long-term study that showed that even women exposed to passive smoke only had higher rates of cervical cancer, which is really pretty interesting. We think that when you smoke, you have exposure to the nicotines and tars in your mucus of your lungs, and actually you get those same concentration in the mucus of the cervix as well. It's been shown that you can get those same products concentrating in that area, and it's thought to be biologically plausible that this could be responsible for the high rates of cervical cancer. We know a lot about what causes cervical cancer. We don't know everything, of course, but we know that the human papillomavirus usually is a prerequisite for cervical cancer, particularly the high-risk types of human papillomavirus. And we think that of the women who contract human papillomavirus, a certain percentage of those women would be targeted to go on for high grades of precancer and then, if untreated, develop a cancer. And we know that some women, however, don't ever go on to develop cancer. And we're continually looking at factors that might help us understand these two groups of women. And exposure to passive smoke might be one possibility.
Have they made some kind of a measurement that would answer this question? Okay, how much exposure you could go from, say, an extreme pole? Mm-hmm. Let's say you work in a restaurant or bar,
sure,
where people are smoking constantly, so you're exposed to that.
Right.
Compare that with the fact that maybe occasionally you go to that place and you spend a little time there, but it's not
sure.
like you spend 6, 7, 8 hours there every day. I mean, how much exposure do you have to get for it to have a measurable kind of effect?
And I'm not sure that they have worked that out. Usually most of these studies look at a lot of exposure versus almost no exposure. And somewhere in the middle, there's probably a happy medium. And maybe, again, there's another factor. For instance, there were some studies at one point in time that seemed to indicate if you were low in B vitamins, that you could be at increased risk for cervical cancer, but then when they did better studies, they couldn't really nail that down. And maybe there's something else besides the passive smoke exposure that you need, and that in certain individuals who are extremely susceptible, perhaps only a little bit of exposure to passive smoke is a problem. So I think the recent study published was one of these retrospective look-back studies, and usually the next step is to figure out something biologically plausible, and I suspect they may need to do some animal studies, which, yeah, controversial in certain groups, but this is the kind of study that's really well-suited to animal models where you could actually expose different animals to different amounts of passive smoke and come up with some sort of a reasonable statement. But from a physician standpoint, it just adds extra weight to people to encourage individuals not ever to be exposed to passive smoke if you're not a smoker.
Yeah. Okay. So do everything that you can to try to reduce your exposure.
Right.
All right. We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dr. Suzanne Troopman. She is an OBGYN. She teaches at U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign once a month. On a Monday, she's on the program. We talk about women's health. And as I said at the beginning, she comes prepared to talk about a few things. But the idea of the program is if you have questions, very specific questions about yourself or someone who's close to you and you want to talk to the doctor, you can do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, number's for you. So use that. It's calls on us, 800-222-9455.
Also, in the past year, the FDA did approve as primary screening a test for the human papillomavirus as part of annual pap smear testing, so that, for instance, if you are age 30 or above, instead of just getting your pap smear, you can get the pap smear plus the HPV test. Used to require two different separate collections of samples, but now that HPV testing for the presence of the human papillomavirus can actually be done from the same liquid preparation that a pap smear is generally taken. And I think that we're going to see a lot more accuracy in the pickup of cervical cancer for people who do get regularly screened. Mm-hmm. The caveat is that there are many women out there who aren't getting regularly screened. And this doesn't mean just missing 1 year. This means that there are individuals out there not having pap smears done for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. And cases like that, I had a patient one time who had actually not had a pap smear in 30 years. And it's usually this group that makes up the biggest group of new cervical cancer cases diagnosed in the United States each year.
Hmm. What, you want to review the basic recommendations then? Should you have one every year?
Well, the recommendations are to get your first pap smear by age 21. This is different. We used to say first pap smear by age 18. It is also a recommendation to have your first pap smear within 3 years of starting sexual activity. So if you were sexually active at 15, you still do need a pap smear by age 18. If you are young and have more than one partner or any risk factors such as exposure to high-risk partner, you should still be getting your pap smear once a year. As a woman gets older, if she has a negative thin prep pap smear 3 years in a row, and she has a negative HPV test, and she and her physician deem that she's relatively low risk category, she might be someone to consider pap smear testing every 2 to 3 years. Over the age of 70, American Cancer Society has said that individuals could consider discontinuing their pap smear testing. Now, they if you have ovaries, you still need pelvic examination. So the pap smear piece is not very much additional activity in the pelvic exam. So most of us do couple the pelvic exam with the pap smear. Medicare does pay for pap smears only every 2 years, and it's 65 is the age of Medicare. So many women over the age of 65 are, in fact, going to the every other year pap smear testing, particularly if they're not at high risk. But then after the age of 70, even though the guidelines say you may discontinue pap smear testing, most of us do not recommend that. And also the newer guidelines talk about if you've had a hysterectomy, no previous abnormal pap smears, you could consider discontinuing pap smear testing or doing it much less frequently. And again, this is where practicing physicians and the guidelines may differ a little bit. And many physicians still either get annual pap smear testing or every 2 to 3 year testing. And actually using this new HPV testing along with the pap smear can help separate out individuals who need a lot of tests versus individuals who don't.
We have talked about the problem with associated with the human papillomavirus. It's something that's sexually transmitted and has been implicated in cancer. I think that we also talked about the fact that there is some research going on into the idea of a vaccine.
Yes.
Now, I guess that's complicated by the fact that there are a lot of different human papillomaviruses.
Correct.
And I don't think that they're all suspected of causing cancer.
Correct.
Maybe just some of them are. So then you would have to pick the ones that you want to target.
Right.
Is there anything new on that front?
Well, quite a bit. There are several companies pursuing vaccine development, which is always good news. Because then we have quite a bit of research going on that can bring to the table a lot of potentially efficacious therapies. We also have companies pursuing the idea that many women, their own immune system can fight off the human papillomavirus. So perhaps the right strategy is to enhance that process. So there's a whole different segment of research that's looking into that, which aren't really truly traditional vaccines, but patient might think they are because they're shots. But of the vaccine development, there's really two companies that are pursuing the vaccines. And one is the idea that there are the quote-unquote low-risk viruses. So these are viruses that primarily cause slightly abnormal pap smears or actual genital warts. And then there are the high-risk type viruses. These cause abnormal pap smears, precancerous changes of the cervix, and most cervical cancers. So one company has looked at the two most likely high-risk viruses that can cause cervical cancers, HPV 16 and 18. They're about 70, and they all get numbered. And HPV 16 and 18, and those two viruses are responsible for about 75% of all cancer cases. And so their idea is to selectively target those couple of viruses. Another company is pursuing looking at a vaccine against four different viruses, two of the most common low-risk viruses that cause abnormal pap smears and genital warts, and the 16 and 18. And that's a quadrivalent vaccine looking at 6, 11, 16, and 18. And their idea is that not only will cases of cervical cancer potentially be prevented, but cases of genital warts will potentially be prevented. And most importantly, for in the United States, this huge group of young people who have abnormal pap smears that have to get extensively tested and perhaps their cervix biopsied to figure out what's going on in these cases. And what we would like to do is rationally approach these very young individuals and help them avoid unnecessary cervical surgeries. And by helping prevent some of these problems, as well as perhaps changing some of the guidelines as to allowing ourselves to watch some of these patients rather than immediately operate, are probably the two biggest factors in preventing unnecessary surgery.
Will condoms prevent the spreading of the virus?
That's always a tricky question, and they probably do help. but they don't really prevent the spread of HPV. And the problem is that the human papillomavirus is a epithelial virus, and that's a fancy way of saying that it can attach to skin surfaces as well as the mucosal surfaces of the vagina, the cervix, the penis, the urethra, and the rectum. It can also attach to the skin surrounding all those structures, and therefore it's intuitively obvious that the condoms don't cover all the surfaces that the human papillomavirus can reside in. And for that reason alone, it's thought that they don't protect against the spread effectively. But as in other areas of sexually transmitted diseases, it's perhaps our best strategy, even though it's not a completely effective strategy. So part of that is that we don't want to leave anyone with the message that condoms aren't effective, because they are so effective for other reasons. And we still think that if you're not having mutually monogamous intercourse with someone who isn't infected, you should be using a condom.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus, Dr. Suzanne Troopman. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She is with us every month on the program to talk about women's health. And questions are certainly welcome if you were here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455.
I thought I would talk a little bit about osteopenia and osteoporosis. And there has been a recent study comparing the two medications, Actonel and Fosamax. And I do get a lot of questions from my patients regarding one medicine versus the other. Patients will ask me, oh, my friend is on one and I'm on the other. Or patients will ask me, my insurance company has asked me to switch medicines because my copay will be significantly less on one versus the other, depending on the company and the contracts. And I think that these are extremely good and important questions. And what I usually try to explain to my patients is that these medicines that are used for bone health really are used in three different settings for both men and women, actually. And one is a high-risk individual who has perfectly normal bone health at the present time but has factors that may lead to an increased risk of both osteoporosis and an osteoporotic fracture in the future. So they get on these medicines strictly for prevention purposes. The second group of patients that use these medicines for bone health are women who test in the category called osteopenia, which is just low bone mass. So they're not at high risk for having an immediate fracture, but just because her bone mass is tested low, she's in a high risk category for becoming osteoporotic. And then finally, the group that is in fact diagnosed with osteoporosis. And just like with cholesterol testing for heart attacks, the number you get assigned, your T-score that you get assigned during a test for your bone density, that is not the only factor in whether or not you're going to have a fracture. So one is we figure out what's the reason that you're on these medications, what are other factors about your case that may make you either need to stay on the therapy or make you low enough risk that you could go off the therapy. And then lastly, what do we do over time to monitor the therapy and how long should you be on it? Because these medicines are relatively new. They've only been on the market somewhere about 5 to 10 years. And the research studies really only have 10 years of data in the longest studies. And like with the estrogens, which were on the market for over 50 years before we had a study that looked into long-term use, we don't have studies that look into long-term use of these medicines. Other factors that have come out that indicate you might be at risk for poor bone health are low vitamin D levels. And I think there was a report I talked about before with low vitamin D levels in individuals who live in the north, which would include us because we have very low sun exposure. I noticed on the Weather Channel, they talk about your UV exposure and so forth. It's really low this time of year. I did notice that. But in many of my research studies, we actually do vitamin D level testing. And I have been surprised to note that some of patients enrolled in our study are, in fact, testing very low in their vitamin D. And actually, just supplementation helps to fill in that gap. And usually the follow-up tests are normal. But it may be something if somebody's really wanting to investigate some of the details about their nutritional status, they may want to look into getting a vitamin D test. So that's something. Also, there was this new study published looking into which medicine you should go on. And it seemed to indicate that perhaps Fosamax had slightly lower levels of irritation of your esophagus than Actonel. And yet they both were tolerated reasonably well. But one of the big problems with these medications is that they can cause a little bit of irritation. They have to be given in fairly strong doses because they aren't absorbed particularly well. So you have to take these medicines first thing without anything else in your stomach and not eat or drink anything else for 30 minutes and not lay back down so you won't have heartburn. And for patients who can follow these instructions, most people can do very well on these medicines without heartburn. But still, heartburn can be a complaint from these medications, and it may be important to consider other alternatives.
Well, is there any problem with using those? And I would think probably someone would want to consult their doctor, but if that's a problem, using them in conjunction with some of the over-the-counter acid-reducing medicines that are also available.
You don't want to take in anything at the same time, but absolutely down the line on other days or much later in the day, you can take those medications and help. We're also looking into other kinds of treatments. So, for instance, we're testing cousin medications of Actonel and Fosamax that can be given either once a week, or actually now we're also testing medications that can be intravenously given. So you can bypass the stomach if you would like and still get an effective therapy. And with the intravenous medicines, the dosing is very infrequent. There are products that have even been shown to be able to be dosed once a year.
We have, we're at our midpoint here, and we certainly have time for other calls. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 if you have questions you'd like to talk with Dr. Trubin about. We got a call from somebody who wanted to ask their question off the air, and it was not particularly specific, but was interested in having you talk about Plan B, the emergency contraceptive. I guess that there has been some controversy about this particular product. Particularly, there are some people who apparently think that an emergency contraceptive like this should be available as an over-the-counter medication so that women could simply go into a pharmacy and buy it. It's not something I have particularly been following. I imagine you probably have. It has a committee of the FDA apparently has recommended that it be made available as an over-the-counter medication. You have some thoughts about that?
Well, basically when it comes to emergency contraceptive protection, so ECP is what we nickname it, there's just been a lot of controversy about it over time. We think that taking a fairly strong, and I'll define what that means, dose of hormone after an episode of unprotected intercourse reduces conception rates dramatically. So that, for instance, if you have an episode of unprotected intercourse right when you're ovulating, there's about an 8 to 10% chance that you're going to conceive. And with some of the standard birth control pills taken in enough pills, and enough maybe quite a few, and the lowest dose pills, you have to take something like 20 of them. But if you take enough of those within 72 hours after intercourse, and actually there are studies that show you could extend that out, then conception rates are reduced to down to about 2%. And in some of the studies with Plan B, which is one of two products that's actually been studied and marketed specifically packaged for this emergency contraception protection, even go down to as low as 1%. So the statistical prevention rate is very, very high. Now, just using morning after pills, which they have been nicknamed, the correct medical term we say, ECP, emergency contraceptive protection, is not as effective as using an effective long-term method of contraception. So it's never going to be a good plan to always use this as your birth control. You're going to have a higher conception rate than if you just get on birth control pills, which have very low conception rate, or something, some other similar method. Now, the first product that came out was an estrogen progesterone combination. Plan B is just a progesterone. It's levonorgestrel. It's one of the progesterones we see in many of the birth control pills. And the company that marketed it originally just marketed it to individual physicians because they were having problems with pharmacies carrying the pills. Now, why did they have problems? Well, most effective emergency contraception protection helps to prevent ovulation. So that in most cases, if it's going to work, it works because the woman has not yet ovulated and the hormonal dose disrupts that scheme. She does not ovulate. Therefore, there's no egg for sperm to fertilize. In cases where a woman actually had ovulated already, most studies show that emergency contraceptive protection would do nothing to that egg, whether it was fertilized or not fertilized. But if you study the lining tissue of the uterus after giving these medicines and a few other biological facts, you can show that the lining tissue of the uterus can be somewhat physiologically altered after taking these medicines. So the thought is that if you ask the researchers and look into the data and say, is it possible in some even rare instances that a fertilized egg would not be able to implant because of these lining changes, and therefore the emergency contraceptive pill could cause an abortion of a fertilized egg? It is probably possible in those kinds of scenarios. But in all the research, it's not likely, and it's extraordinarily rare, if ever. It's not even really been proven that that could happen. So, but because of that, the aura of does this cause an abortion, for instance, it's very difficult in small towns in central Illinois. Most patients, if they want an emergency contraceptive pill, they have to go who knows where to get one. So that's whether you get a prescription or not a prescription. Getting a prescription definitely is one step that blocks the use of these medications. My practice, and I believe at some Planned Parenthoods, you can call up over the phone, particularly during the week. I don't have enough staff to handle these calls over the weekend for myself as being an individual in practice, but you can call up and actually get a prescription over the phone, but then you have to go to a city that has a pharmacy that allows this. Many studies have been done to show that using this medication effectively and responsibly by purchasing it over the counter or making the patient have that knowledge that she needs, that she can go get this medication, have been done. But the glitch has been when the FDA has looked into this and in the past is they worry that there wasn't enough specific data for very young people purchasing it. when it was available over the counter. So that has been a glitch, and I haven't followed the FDA releases in the past couple of weeks. I don't know if where they've gone with that, because that's been the sticking point in committee. But even if they were to pass it to be able to be available over the counter, there's going to be still an issue of where is it going to be available. If it's not available by prescription in many of these places, I think that it may still be a political hurdle more than a medical hurdle to really have it be available. But it's been estimated that we could reduce and eliminate 3/4 of the abortions done in the United States if we had widely available emergency contraception protection. And we reduce them by preventing ovulation, not by causing an earlier an abortion. So I think that, you know, virtually all obstetrician gynecologists strongly endorse not only emergency contraception protection, but I think virtually all realize that there can be very safe scenarios for this medication to go over the counter as well. I'm not a spokesperson for all doctors. I probably should retract that in some sense. But when I talk to physicians, they are very much in favor. And so hopefully it will be something that people can obtain more easily.
All right. We have another caller here, someone in Urbana. We'll get right to. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She's on the faculty of the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign once a month for a long time now. She's been here stopping by on a Monday to talk about women's health. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Good morning. I think I may have had a bladder infection, which only lasted a week, and I wondered, A, is that possible, and B, should I follow up with an appointment to my gynecologist? What happened is I was urinating about once every hour and a half, and was having leaking problems, and, you know, it just sort of happened suddenly. And I happened to, and my gynecologist was out of town, and I happened to have two quarts of cranberry relish, 2 pounds actually of cranberry relish in the house. And so I just ate that and drank lots of liquid and lots of orange juice and lots of cranberry juice, and my problem stopped. And I wondered, you know, was that a bladder infection that, you know, hits and goes away like that? And should I be making an appointment?
Well, it is very possible that it was a bladder infection. It's also very possible that you treated effectively with the extra intake of cranberries. And lastly, if the symptoms recur rather than self-treating it, you should probably at least get a culture. And if you have a regular physician, sometimes it's possible to call them up and they can just send you to the lab for a culture. Or if you're enough curious and you want to spend a little bit of time and effort, you can now get a culture and make sure that whatever bacterial growth was there is at least reduced or gone.
Would that sort of frequency and leaking be consistent with a bladder infection, or would it be something more serious?
It is consistent with a bladder infection. It's actually consistent with minor vaginal infections as well. So when you self-diagnose without all the tests, we can't really confirm or refute one way or the other.
It was between Christmas and New Year's, and I, you know, sure, just couldn't get hold of anybody. So I probably should make an appointment then with my gynecologist and get a culture.
You can get a culture, or just get on the phone. Maybe they'll just send you to the laboratory. In some parts of the country, they allow people to self-order tests. You just show up at a laboratory and say, I need this test.
Really?
But I don't think that that's common around this part of the country. But what I was going to say physiologically for other listeners who may have had some sort of similar type episodes is that women don't necessarily completely empty their bladder with each void. Probably men don't either. But some women keep a very small amount of urine in their bladder, and it becomes a medical problem if you keep too much. And the urine within the bladder – if thoroughly tested, often has some bacteria. And it's not considered an infection unless that bacterial growth gets very out of hand and is very large and then produces other kinds of physiologic responses from the bladder wall, and then that truly becomes an infection. And the cranberry juice, and actually for those who don't want the calories, I think you said you had relish, but juices and other products, they're actually pills of the cranberry extract, and blueberries work very well too. Huh. And there's actually blueberry pills too. And those compounds work by changing the chemical composition of the urine to reduce that bacterial overgrowth. And if you catch it early enough, and also the extra fluid is merely it's like washing out. It's just, you know, if you get a stain and you wash with, mm-hmm. you know, water, you get wipe the stain out, and it's really simply a dilutional technique as well.
Right,
but those are both very good strategies for handling the symptoms. But if it was bad enough and confusing enough, then following it up with a culture when you can get contact with your healthcare provider is usually a reasonable strategy.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is the kind of thing that I think that was that was on the level of a folk remedy for a long time, that people
right.
believed that cranberry juice would help reduce urinary tract infections in women and men,
sure.
both, and that now I think there actually is some evidence,
oh, yes,
some research
is.
Evidence that says, yes, it's not just that people think that it does, that it actually does.
Right. And that's what's been great in the past 15, 20 years. Various researchers in various fields have taken old folk remedies and tested them. Some of my favorites are like using warm cabbage leaves to help with milk engorgement right after birthing. You know, if the breasts are uncomfortable, that works. And there's a lot of kind of fun ones like that.
Warm cabbage leaves.
Yep.
Well, it wouldn't be very
Chicken
expensive
soup.
To try it. Oh, well, that's good for everything,
well
isn't it?
Well documented.
Oh, we have other callers. Morton Grove is next. This is line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Good morning.
Yes.
I wonder if I could, I want to refer you to a problem my sister's just been diagnosed with, which is cancer of the uterus. And she is over 60 and diabetic and... there may be some surgery called for here, and if so, I was wondering if you could tell me about the prognosis of this.
Well, when individuals say cancer of the uterus, most likely they're referring to something called endometrial cancer, which is technically speaking cancer of the lining of the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
And typically when a cancer in this part of the body develops, women get some sort of vaginal bleeding or bloody discharge.
Yeah.
So that's actually a good thing because it's a signal to the woman and her healthcare provider that something's going on. It's a relatively easy operation to do a biopsy of that lining or strictly in the office, or a slightly more complete procedure by doing a dilatation, curettage, or hysteroscopy to actually get a sample of that lining and make the diagnosis. So that we have been fortunate with this type of cancer to typically pick these cancers up mostly in stage 1 and a few in stage 2, and it's very uncommon for the more advanced stages of endometrial cancer to present. It can't happen. But most of them are in the very earliest stage, and in the earliest stage, endometrial cancer of the uterus is quite treatable by a hysterectomy. So usually what a physician will do first is get the tissue diagnosis, then do what's called a outpatient clinical staging, and then typically the next step is usually a complete hysterectomy, including the cervix, the uterus, and the tubes and ovaries, and some lymph node samplings if indicated. And then from all those pieces of information, come up with some statistics for you in terms of cure rates, which in stage 1 can be as high as in the 90% range, and some longer-term treatments. And sometimes you're done with the treatment after the hysterectomy. So,
could you say what the long-term treatment might involve?
sometimes it involves radiation, and sometimes it involves hormonal therapy, and sometimes it involves chemotherapy. But many of the patients that are diagnosed in the very earliest stages are completely treated after their hysterectomy.
So the prognosis is generally good. If
more favorable than other cancers, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you'd like to make sure that it's the area where is affected is they restricted to the uterus as opposed to any place in addition to, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what we're hoping for. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for the information.
All right, very good. Let's go on to another caller here. The next in line would be Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, yesterday I was reading in the Observer out of the UK a article by a columnist doctor, I guess, and it's about drinking sparkling versus plain mineral water. And in a group of women, some research was done. I was wondering if you knew anything about this idea. He claims in this article that the drinking of sparkling water brings about significant reductions in the level of LDL and increases HDL, and therefore is likely to reduce heart disease risk over plain water.
You know, I'm vaguely remembering that I saw a headline and I was curious about it and I meant to look more into it and I didn't. So I can't really give you any specifics without looking into it more, but maybe it's something I can look into for next month. But sparkling water does tend to be carbonated, which is why it has its sparkling components. And I do know that you have to space your calcium intake out relative to when you have an intake of sparkling water. So that can always be a consideration. But I can't, off the top of my head, think of any biological reason why the carbonation would help with your lipid profile. I'm not sure. There's been a lot of interest lately in terms of protection against heart disease in looking at the levels of inflammation in our system, particularly looking at a blood test called cardio-C-reactive protein, which is elevated in people with high cholesterol, and it's elevated in people with normal cholesterol levels as well. And there's a lot of interest in studying this component. In the past, I would tell my patients that had high C-reactive proteins to take aspirin. And maybe there's something to do with, I don't know if they went on to say whether it would have an impact on heart disease if you were consuming mineral water versus carbonated.
Yeah, that's what they're implying because of the effect on the LDL and HDL.
But because of the specific effects on the carbonation,
they don't know why either. They're just saying that showed up in a study
in an epidemiologic study where they looked at two groups of patients, that one that mostly consumed carbonated versus one that didn't.
Yeah, actually, it says it was a group of women, and they asked them to drink a liter of either sparkling or what they call still each day for 2 months, followed by 2 months on the other water. And then they were tested the whole time for, like, blood pressure and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I thought that's kind of funny.
It is interesting.
Because my wife really likes sparkling water, and I could never quite understand why. I'm curious that this
can be your palate.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right. Well, there we have about 10 minutes left, a little bit less, 7-8 minutes maybe, with our guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. And if you have questions, this is our monthly program on women's health, something that we do on a Monday once a month on a regular basis. We built it into the schedule expecting that listeners would always have questions in this area, and she has been doing the program with us now for a long time. She has a practice here in our area, private practice as an obstetrician gynecologist. She also teaches in the U of I College of Medicine here in Urbana-Champaign. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I can't think of any, I mean, maybe not that I would know, but I couldn't think of any, why having the water bicarbonated would make any difference
and
at
I
all.
And I don't know that sparkling water versus mineral water has any difference in actual mineral content. That I would have to look up, but mm-hmm. I'm going to look into it.
All right.
I like sparkling water too.
Okay. Well, it seems like it's a little more jazzy because it's got that fizz.
Yeah, but I don't buy it that much. I usually drink tap water.
Oh, okay.
But we've always had good water around
all right.
here.
Well, that's true. We do. In Champaign-Urbana, we're lucky we have good water. Okay. Well, next, talk with someone else in Urbana. Line one, right here. Hello.
Hello. On the evening news the other day, I heard a Dr. Trice talking about that in early stages of arthritis, that some a bone, gee, I can't think of the words I want to say, can be restored. I mean, the cushioning, what is the word I want to think of? Can be restored. You know, what is it that wears off in the bone when you have arthritis?
Well,
and he said that can be restored, and I didn't know how, and do you know anything about that?
I haven't studied any recent literature on arthritis. There has been a lot of progress, but of course, a lot of the controversy right now that I've been following has to do with long-term users of Vioxx and Celebrex yeah. and non-steroidal compounds and the rational use of those medicines and whether or not it makes sense to switch patients on to
yeah.
Tylenol. And I know there are more sophisticated medications for arthritis, and yeah. I was somewhat waiting for the dust to settle on some of this research because even the Vioxx, which was taken off of the market, and the research with Celebrex, it also casts some questions about the long-term safety for individuals with respect to heart disease and these compounds. They were using these medicines in extremely high doses over very long times, not exactly the way arthritis patients use them. So that's the only research I was watching. But
so this is not my question. My question was, he said cartilage could be, and I don't know how they could do it. Cartilage could be, you know, added again to the bone.
Well, it makes sense because our cartilage, like our bones, does remodel to some extent. So it does make sense, but I don't think that I can offer advice as to a rational strategy for individual arthritis sufferers.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. We'll go on to line number four. This is a caller down in southeastern Illinois. Hello.
Yes, it has been suggested that since the cessation of brain waves is the standard used to determine when death occurs, that the beginning of brain waves could be a standard to determine when life occurs. At what point in pregnancy do brain waves first occur?
I haven't thought about that. But I would think that you could probably, I don't know the formal definition of wave and whether or not the waves in the brain, the fetal brain are somewhat identical to the so-called waves of an adult brain. I'm not sure. The brain keeps developing up until age two. You have neuronal tissue very early within the first weeks, and then a little knob forms at the top of what is eventually the spinal cord, and that's the brain stem. And there's some development of that after the first trimester, but exactly when the neurologist could detect something, I don't know. It's too detailed of a question. I would have to look it up.
Okay, just offhand, too, there's another thing. I've heard that in the beginning of a pregnancy that all embryos are female, and that at some point later in the pregnancy, some of the embryos or fetuses are upgraded into the deluxe model. When does that occur?
Well, we don't really say that. We say that it's in an undifferentiated state. The fetus is undifferentiated into male or female genitalia. Now, the most eggs are either XX or XY. So if you want to use the genetic definition, in the beginning, you're either an XX or an XY. And there are a few more female eggs than males. But after that point in time, it's right around the 15th week of gestation where the external genitalia then differentiates based on the biological signal into something that resembles a female or resembles a male. And that's when then the vaginal canal and the embryonic uterus and so forth are developing.
But really, if from the beginning you have an XX or an XY, well, you really have sex determination from the beginning. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right. We're at just about the point where we're going to have to stop. I think we have one more call that we're just not going to take because we don't have the time. But we'll promise again that Dr. Trupin will be back again next month. Any last thing you want to mention before we go?
Not too much. We have a lot of studies enrolling. If anybody wants to check out my website at womenshealthpractice.com, they could.
All right. Thanks. Dr. Suzanne Trupin, she has practice here in obstetrics and gynecology in our area. She also teaches at U of I Med School. And once a month on this program, always on Monday, she stops by. We talk about women's health.